Chapter 4. Digging into Nineveh. Babylon and Nineveh, these great biblical cities, were the stuff of romance. The Old Testament told of King Nebuchadnezzar, who reigned from about 604 to 562 BC, the greatest king of ancient Babylon, in today's southern Iraq. He was a ruthless conqueror, famous for holding Jews captive in his capital. The proceeds from his mighty empire created a magnificent capital. According to later Greek accounts, thousands of slaves erected city walls so thick that chariots could race along the top. Nebuchadnezzar allegedly created fabulous hanging gardens for his terraced palace, which became one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Whether they ever existed is an open question. His capital vanished when Assyrian civilization collapsed. The few European travelers who reached Babylon found themselves in an arid wilderness of dusty mounds. Centuries passed before German archaeologists could reconstruct parts of it. See Chapter 20. Nineveh lay far upstream in what is now northern Iraq. In 612 BC, it was a major Assyrian city, mentioned in the book of Genesis in the Bible. According to the prophet Isaiah, God doomed the arrogant Ninevites. He made Nineveh a desolation and dry like a wilderness. No buildings or temples remained to be seen above the ground. Later, European visitors remarked that God's wrath had indeed destroyed the Assyrians. Babylon and Nineveh passed into the historical shadows known only from the Bible. There they remained until amazing archaeological finds confirmed biblical history. In 1841, a group of influential scholars in the French Asiatic Society seized on Nineveh as another opportunity for dramatic excavations that would reflect well on France. In 1842, the government appointed Paul-Émile Botha, 1802-70, as its consul or representative in Mosul. Botha had been a diplomat in Egypt, and it was his fluent Arabic that led to this new appointment. His unofficial task was to excavate Nineveh, even though he had no relevant experience. Botha's unsophisticated diggings were largely fruitless, since he was penetrating only the sterile upper layers of Nineveh's Qiyanjik mound, that is, layers with no bones or tools. City mounds, like Nineveh's, were formed gradually, layer by layer. The earliest, often most important, levels were at the bottom. But Botha knew nothing of such sites. He dug around near the surface and found some inscribed bricks and alabaster fragments, but nothing spectacular. Then, after months of labor, his luck changed. A villager from Khorsabad, some 22 kilometers north of Qiyanjik, showed Botha some inscribed bricks. He told stories of numerous finds around his house in an ancient mound. The consul sent two men to investigate. A week later, one of them returned in great excitement. A little digging had revealed walls carved with images of exotic animals. Botha rode to Khorsabad at once. He was astounded by the elaborate carvings exposed in the walls of the small pit that had been dug. Unfamiliar bearded men wearing long gowns walked alongside winged animals and other beasts. Botha quickly moved his workers to Khorsabad. Within a few days, the excavators uncovered a series of sculpted limestone slabs from the palace of an ancient and unknown king. Botha wrote to Paris in triumph, claiming to have revealed a biblical truth. "Nineveh is rediscovered," he proudly reported. The French government gave a grant of 3,000 francs for further excavations. Botha employed more than 300 workers, knowing that he had to dig on a large scale to make important finds. He started a tradition of enormous excavations in Mesopotamia, from the Greek meaning the land between the rivers, that continued well into the 20th century. Wisely, the French also sent out Eugene Napoleon Flandin, an experienced archaeological artist from Paris. The two men labored on the mounds until late October 1844. they unearthed the outline of an enclosed palace compound that covered over 2.5 square kilometers. The workmen merely followed the walls of the palace wherever they could. They uncovered scenes of a king at war, besieging cities, hunting game, and engaging in elaborate religious ceremonies. Human-headed lions and bulls guarded the palace gates. Never had an excavation yielded such treasures. Flandin arrived in Paris in November 1844 with drawings that filled French scholars with joy. This was an entirely new art tradition, quite unlike that of Greece, the Nile, or Rome. Botta also returned to Paris. He completed a report on the excavations, accompanied by four volumes of Flandin's drawings, and this caused a sensation. Botta claimed, wrongly, that he had rediscovered Nineveh at Khorsabad. You can't blame him. Like Belzoni in Egypt, he was unable to read the palace inscriptions. We now know that he had excavated Dur-Sharrukin, the palace of Assyrian king Sargon II, 722 to 705 BC. An aggressive, successful conqueror. Years were to pass before so-called cuneiform, from the Latin for wedge because of its shape, inscriptions identified his capital. See Chapter 5. In that time, Botta retreated from view, being assigned to an obscure post in Lebanon, and never returning to archaeology. But just as Botta was starting work at Nineveh in 1842, a young Englishman by the name of Austin Henry Layard, 1817 to 94, was becoming fascinated by archaeology in Mesopotamia. He had spent 2 weeks at Nineveh in 1840, studying the site. Blessed with an insatiable curiosity and outstanding powers of observation, he became determined to excavate ancient city mounds. Archaeology became his passion. Like many great archaeologists, Layard was always restless. He went off to spend a year among the Bakhtiari nomads in the mountains of Persia, now Iran, becoming a trusted advisor to the tribe. He knew so much about local politics that the British envoy in Baghdad sent him to Constantinople to advise the ambassador there. At this point, in 1842, he spent 3 days in Mosul with Botta, who encouraged him to dig. Layard, however, was penniless. He spent 3 years as an unofficial intelligence officer in Constantinople. Then the British ambassador, Sir Stratford Canning, reluctantly allowed him 2 months to excavate at Nimrud, a series of mounds downstream from Mosul. Layard gambled that he would get to the heart of the city from the bottom, and so he tunneled into the mounds. Almost immediately, the workers uncovered a large chamber lined with cuneiform inscribed slabs. We now know that this was the north palace of Assyrian king Ashurnasirpal, 883 to 859 BC. That same day, Layard moved men to the south and unearthed the southwest palace, built by King Esarhaddon, 681 to 669 BC. Layard remains the only archaeologist ever to have found two palaces within 24 hours. His excavations simply followed the decorated walls of the palace rooms. Layard found stockpiled carvings from an earlier palace, including scenes of a battle and of a siege. These finds soon overshadowed those at Khorsabad. Layard worked with one objective in mind, to discover breathtaking artworks and artifacts that could be shipped to London. He knew that exotic finds sent to the British Museum would place him firmly in the public eye. By no stretch of the imagination could his work be described as careful recording. Layard and his Assyrian assistant, Hormuzd Rassam, set up camp atop the Nimrud Mound, which gave them a superb view of the surrounding plains. Layard was constantly on his guard against sudden raids from neighboring tribesmen in search of treasure. He lavished the local chiefs with gifts to buy their loyalty, but did not hesitate to use violence if needed. Eventually, he became a kind of chief himself, settling disputes and arranging marriages. Extraordinary discoveries followed, including three winged bull sculptures which guarded the palace. Layard threw a 3-day party for his workers to celebrate these finds. In the North Palace, his men unearthed a magnificent carved pillar depicting a king receiving tribute. It recorded the military triumphs of King Shalmaneser III, 859 to 824 BC, who fought constantly with neighboring states, including the Hittites. See Chapter 20. Layard built a large wagon and hauled the heavy finds to the Tigris. The artifacts were floated downstream to Basra on rafts supported by inflated goatskins, identical to those shown on Assyrian reliefs. Next, Layard dug into the Kianjik Mound at Nineveh, where tunnels soon exposed nine chambers adorned with bas-reliefs, sculptures where the figures barely stand out from the surface. The first load of Nimrud sculptures reached the British Museum on June 22, 1847. And when Layard arrived in England, he found himself the hero of the hour. In 1849, he published Nineveh and Its Remains, a slight sketch of his work that became a bestseller. Excavations at Kianjik resumed in 1849. Layard dug a labyrinth of tunnels which followed decorated palace walls and ignored the precious room contents. Again, he spent days underground sketching the carvings as they appeared, by the light of ventilation shafts and candles. Dimly lit tunnels led to great lion figures that guarded palace gates. The limestone slabs of the entrances still bore the ruts of Assyrian chariot wheels. Layard's workers exposed the entire southeast facade of the palace of King Sennacherib, 705 to 681 BC, who campaigned in Mesopotamia, Syria, Israel, and Judea. The palace inscriptions offered a chronicle of conquests, sieges, and royal achievements. Lifelike monarchs and gods appeared in relief, as if they were stepping forward to question the intruding visitors. Many Kianjik reliefs are now on display in the British Museum, and I always make a point of visiting them. The carving is stunning. A set of reliefs shows nearly 300 laborers dragging a great human-headed bull from a river raft to the palace. A man seated astride the bull directs the work. Meanwhile, the king supervises from his chariot, shaded by a parasol. Layard's most sensational discovery came when he uncovered the siege and capture of an unknown city. Unknown, that is, until the accompanying cuneiform inscriptions were deciphered in the 1850s. See Chapter 5. Reliefs were his primary concern. Small finds, unless valuable, were of little interest. The excavations yielded the occasional clay tablet with a cuneiform inscription, but many of these fell to dust, being unfired and fragile. Then Layard struck gold, although it was some time before he realized it. Towards the end of the dig, he shoveled hundreds of inscribed clay tablets into six crates. These had formed part of the royal library and turned out to be one of his most important discoveries. After the 1850 excavations, he shipped more than 100 crates down the River Tigris. After an unsuccessful excavation attempt at Babylon and another early southern city, which failed because his methods were too crude to handle the unfired brick, Layard returned home. The British Museum has many sketches in Layard's hand, the only record of the finds that he could not ship. He had the great archaeologist's instinct for the important rather than the trivial, and, like Giovanni Belzoni, he had a nose for discovery that led him to royal palaces and spectacular finds. But his methods were appallingly crude, and much was lost. Half a century was to pass before German scholars turned archaeological excavation in Greece and Mesopotamia into a scientific discipline. See Chapter 20. Layard is hard to figure out. By any standards, he was a hurried, ruthless excavator in search of exciting discoveries and treasure. He dug entire cities with only one or two European assistants and hundreds of local workers. Ultimately, all he cared about was fame and dazzling Assyrian finds for the British Museum. He did excel, however, at dealing with local people, many of whom became firm friends, unusual among the early archaeologists. For all his eloquent writing and fluent descriptions, Austin Henry Layard was ultimately an adventurer as much as an archaeologist. But he did bring the biblical Assyrians into the spotlight and showed that much of the Old Testament was based on historical events. The deciphering of cuneiform script soon made his finds even more important. See chapter 5. Exhausted after his demanding excavations and fed up with the constant struggle to obtain funds, Layard gave up archaeology at the age of 36. Instead, he changed gears and became a politician, then a diplomat, a job that drew on his expertise at dealing with people from other cultures. Eventually, he was to become the British ambassador in Constantinople, at the time one of the most important diplomatic posts in Europe. Not bad for an adventurer archaeologist.